Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Life of a Song. This is a special episode to celebrate the publication of a book based on columns in the series. I'm Ludovic Hunter-Tilney, the FT's pop critic, and I'm joined by two FT pop writers, David Cheel.
Hello.
And Helen Brown.
Hi.
David, you commissioned the Life of a Song series. Tell me about this book that we've had produced of the series.
Well, for about 2.5 years now, the FT Weekend has been publishing a weekly series called The Life of a Song, in which every week there's a different song. It tells the biography, the story of the song, how it was written, the sort of social times that it fell into, and how it was subsequently covered and treated, or sometimes mistreated. And this book is a compilation of 50 of those columns, a kind of greatest hits compilation, if you like, and it comes out later this month.
And it ranges across all styles of music, doesn't
all
it?
All styles of music and all eras as well. Some of the songs go back several centuries.
And today, to give listeners who may not be familiar with the series a sort of sense of its flavour, we will be talking about 4 of the songs that are included in the book. These are the songs that shook the world, is how we are titling them. Each of these songs has made an impact in their own way. Some have been have made a very dramatic and immediate impact, have sort of gripped people's attentions and imaginations. Others have sort of filtered into popular consciousness over time and have become suddenly part of the sort of musical landscape in people's lives. Others have actually made a completely wrong impression, or at least not the impression that their songwriter intended. And we're going to start with a song that you wrote about, David.
That's right.
You begin your column on this song with the words, "Can a pop song change the world?" The song in question is David Bowie's Starman, released in 1972. There's a star. So this song was a big hit for Bowie in 1972 and That's made right. a very dramatic impression, didn't it, David?
It did.
I believe on yourself too.
It did, yes. It was David Bowie's breakthrough hit. But for me personally, and I think from what I've gathered for a lot of other people, I remember vividly watching him on the BBC's Top of the Pops and seeing this sort of androgynous, Bako foil-clad, otherworldly creature. And you could sort of sense newspapers being rustled with disapproval by parents up and down the country while their offspring looked on in sort of amazement.
In the room with your parents?
I was, yes. Yes. And there was this sort of sense of otherness, that there are others who are other. And it was a sort of a striking moment of realisation that boys and girls, there were people who were in between, and Bowie looked like that. And there was a moment when David Bowie draped his arm around his guitarist Mick Ronson's shoulder, and it wasn't a sort of a blokey, chappy, chummy sort of drape. It was quite feminine, the way he sort of just rested his fingers very gently on Ronson's shoulders. And that again just sort of spoke of a different kind of relationship between two men.
This has become a sort of very storied episode, hasn't it, in British music, that this
has,
one
yeah.
moment is
yeah. God,
there are certain dates which really sort of leap out at one, as when everything yeah. seems to, the earth on its fulcrum seems to turn around. And do you think that that really was the case in terms of the music that followed on from there?
Musically, it's not a terribly outrageous song. It's a fairly conventional pop song, although it's a sensationally catchy one. I think what sort of struck people, I mean, there's a lot of people like Neil Tennant of the Pet Shop Boys, Holly Johnson of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and also people like fashion designers who all trace their sort of, you know, development back to this key moment. It's a pop cultural historical moment and not just a pop moment.
The song came out, I mean, before the Top of the Pops appearance. I mean, he toured it in February. The Top of the Pops appearance doesn't happen till July. It is about that television performance, and there's a moment before Bowie went on stage where he's queuing up in the corridor and he's opposite Status Quo and they're all still in their full-on denim. Francis Rossi just takes one look at these spectacular quilted jumpsuits and, you know, says, "You make us feel old." It's that whole key shift.
And so looking at the song itself, I mean, the story it's telling, tell us something, David, about what the song is actually about in terms of the persona that Bowie created here.
He'd taken on the persona of Ziggy Stardust, and the song is really about this sort of guy who's going to come down from the sky and basically kind of save us, I guess, from ourselves. There's a musical motif in there, which you'll also hear in Wichita Lineman, which is this sort of Morse code thing that comes in the chorus, which is sort of signifying some kind of message going out or message being received.
And the life of this particular song, I mean, it changed the course of Bowie's career, didn't it?
Yeah.
And sort of launched him then onto a phase of very great success.
Very much into the mainstream. Yeah.
And also, it was the beginning of kind of that self-created individual pop star, wasn't it? I mean, he said, "I'm an instant superstar, just add water and stir." You know, he was really struggling for 3 years. He wasn't getting music out. Things weren't happening for him. And he really went all out to create the self-image, which is what you then end up with people like Madonna constantly reinventing themselves and doing. Mm. So, he was the first guy to kind of consciously do that, to create something, to send his fashion designer off to Liberty and say, "I want these suits, I want this makeup." Mick Ronson didn't even want to wear the outfits. He stormed off and had to be talked around by the drummer into wearing all this gear.
And evidently, this is an example of a song that can actually change everything for an individual, in so much as it was written. I believe that the album lacked anything that the record label thought they could release as a single. So then he went away and wrote this the single.
Yeah.
So there's something within a song itself when it can capture everyone's attention and can suddenly spread out. I mean, we saw it more recently with songs such as Shape of You, the Sheeran song, which suddenly seems to be everywhere.
Yeah.
You can't escape it. This song, 45 years ago, where Top of the Pops would have been the way in which suddenly it's there, whereas
it's
now, of course...
conscious branding, mission statement. Yeah. It's the whole thing, isn't it? Shabam.
But, do you think, Helen, that sort of drama can be achieved nowadays when we have so many different ways in which a song can be placed out towards its audience, for its audience? I mean, we don't have any single medium which everyone's going to go and tune into.
I mean, they're trying, aren't they? So you've got stars like Jay-Z and Beyonce who will do those sudden secret... I mean, even Bowie surprised us with his last album dropped on his birthday, and people didn't know that was coming. Artists are still trying to create that sense of event, that sense of moment. You can only hear it this way. You can only listen to Jay-Z on Tidal or whatever. They're still trying to create it, but I think it's increasingly difficult.
Yeah. You're not going to get kids like, you know, like the day after Top of the Pops going into school saying, you know, "God, did you see that David Bowie on Top of the Pops last night?" And I have to say that quite a few of my schoolmates were kind of horrified rather than amazed because of the kind of rampant homophobia of the time.
And David, further versions of the song, tell us about how the song then, having established itself so dramatically, has it continued? Did it continue a dramatic course, as it were, through the annals of music?
I wouldn't say it's had a huge kind of afterlife. People have played with it. One of the people who did so was a Brazilian singer called Seu Jorge, who pops up throughout. People might remember the Wes Anderson film, The Life Aquatic. Jorge pops up through the film singing David Bowie songs in Portuguese, and he does this with Starman. I think he's sitting on the deck late at night of the boat, smoking a cigarette. Quero um machado pra quebrar o gelo, quero acordar o sonho agora mesmo.
Helen, that particular version do it for you?
Yeah, I really like that. And I like the film. I mean, the film did the same thing. It was taking you back into the early days of sort of underwater photography, underwater exploration, when the colours of everything suddenly shifted. They had those heightened colours. So, yeah, I mean, certainly in the context of the film, I love that version. I love the way that you're comparing the astronaut with the deep sea diver, this person going into this vivid, colourful new world.
True then to the song of how Bowie went and also introduced the world of colour into the young Cheels household.
Yes, exactly.
Listeners may not be able to, well, obviously cannot see David, but I can assure you he is sitting here in a spandex jumpsuit right now. We shall move on now to a related song. This is a song that Helen wrote about, which is in the book. It has a link to Starman. It is Somewhere Over the Rainbow from the film The Wizard of Oz, sung by Judy Garland.
Somewhere dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind.
Well, everyone here has gone quite dewy-eyed. Now, Helen, first of all, could you elucidate for us, please, the link between that song and Starman?
Yes. So where the young Judy Garland is singing it in her barnyard in Kansas, waiting for the grey world to turn into this multicoloured world of Oz, she leaps up the octave. It's the first note up the octave. And it was the same thing that David Bowie wanted to do with Starman. He wanted to take us out of dull, grey 1970s Britain. And he wanted to transport us into a brave new world of bright new colours. So he borrowed the same octave leap from Over the Rainbow.
Did he do it as well as Judy Garland?
I don't think Starman is as good a song as Over the Rainbow. But I think he does that fantastic thing of borrowing an emotion, borrowing a mood, and he borrowed that octave leap. And I was reading about the octave leap recently. For a start, the producers of Over the Rainbow were worried about selling the sheet music of Over the Rainbow because of, they didn't think the average Joe would want to buy it because it was very difficult to sing. And scientifically, it's called the miracle of music, the octave jump. And they've recently discovered that cats and monkeys can recognise that music miracle, whereas children under 9 struggle with it.
Really?
Yeah, that's my weird scientific fact.
So at these two points, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and then later on with Starman, it would have been cats and monkeys as well. They would have been very struck by this. 1972, Top of the Pops, Any monkeys or cats tuning in would have been
feeling the vibe. But of course, it's about optimism, isn't it? It's the lyrics of the Over the Rainbow were written by a guy called Yip Harburg, who was very passionate about liberal values and changing the world. And he saw Over the Rainbow, the story, as what could be achieved in Roosevelt's America. So he was all about, you know, America just needed to find its heart, its brain and its courage. And Yip Harburg's son says the most important word in the whole song is dare. So it's the dreams that you dare to dream. And so there's something of that courageous octave leap that we can make a brighter future.
Now, the song itself has now become one of the most famous songs ever written. I mean, it really it's extraordinary,
America's
the extent to which...
to some extent.
And just seems to turn up everywhere. I mean, even so far as the prog rock group Toto. There's some theories that they took their name from Dorothy's dog. How did this song manage to become such a sort of key part of our imaginations?
When The Wizard of Oz was released in 1939, well, we were in the middle of a Great Depression. And I think it was the film that everybody went to see. It was the film that people's lives were very, very hard. And the author, Yip Harburg, he came from a slum. So his parents were Russian Jewish immigrants. He was the youngest of 4 of 10 surviving children. Parents worked in a sweatshop. His whole career was about bringing hope to the working man. And so that's what the film did. And I think it's the American dream. Anyone can make it. Yip Harburg would write songs about women's rights. He wrote the first all-black musical that was turned into a film. He wrote the first musical.
Didn't they write Brother Can You Spare a Dime?
Yeah.
As well.
So he started out with Brother Can You Spare a Dime, which is the unofficial song of the Roosevelt campaign trail.
And Helen, in your column, you quote Yip Harburg. You quote him on the subject of songwriting. Words make you feel a thought, he said. Music makes you feel a feeling. A song makes you feel a thought. Would you care to sort of like explain your thoughts about that?
It's just the truth, isn't it? I mean, he had lived all of this. After growing up in a slum, he had been drafted into the First World War that he didn't believe in. He then set out in a world of business. He became shareholder in an electrical appliance company, which tanked in the recession, leaving him in tens of thousands of debt, which he took his lifetime almost to pay back. You know, and he once said, I left the fantasy of business for the hard reality of show business. So he'd lived it and he wanted to make people feel it, but he also wanted to change the world.
Which then takes us back to that question that, David, that you asked at the beginning of your column on Starman, whether songs can change the world. I mean, obviously, the invention of printing changed the world. The discovery of penicillin changed the world. But can we really say that something as insubstantial seeming as a song, a sort of 3-minute song, is able to change the world?
I think so. I think you can sort of sense a little bit of a tilting of the axis when Starman came out and Over the Rainbow as well. If you're sort of introducing new ideas or new feelings into a culture, I think that in a way is sort of changing the world. You're not sort of saying, you know, it's not like protest songs. I'm not sure about the effectiveness of protest songs. It's a feeling, isn't it? And a notion that's being introduced into the culture. And I think that changes things.
It changes your heart, doesn't it? I mean, Over the Rainbow was the song that Ariana Grande sang at the end of the Manchester concert. You know, when you want to fight back against the worst things that can happen in the world, when you want to unify an arena full of people with love and hope and the sense that things can get better, that things can improve, then this is the song you choose.
It became Judy Garland's signature song. Yeah. And you mention a very interesting detail in your, when you write about it, is that in her last concert in 1969, you describe as giving a hollow laugh before she sang it. I mean, did the song itself become something, some sort of an anchor for her, something which was actually became too heavy?
Yeah, well, I think it was her signature song. And as her life took sadder and sadder turns, I think that she was being wheeled out to sing this song of joy and optimism, which was so at odds with her personal state at the time, then yes, her cynicism just cracked through in that final performance a few months before her overdose.
And there have obviously been numerous other versions. It's turned up in all manner of ways, one of which is Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah, that was the song that Gene Wilder wanted to be listening to as he died.
Keeping it merry, so, keeping it merry, Ellen.
Optimism, yeah.
Just a step beyond the rain. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Do you feel that song does justice to, or not, to the original?
Oh, it's lovely.
Yes.
It's, and what she does as well, which is what the song does, is it oozes between notes. And quite often people do that in octave jumping songs. So, for example, a later example of someone who jumps the octave would be Aka Bilk on Stranger on the Shore in 1961. And it's that lovely clarinet ooze up the note, up the octave at the beginning. And that's what Ella Fitzgerald does. She just trickles over songs, doesn't she?
Is there a sense that she's bringing that song into a tradition of Black American pop music with its associations with the church, gospel music, and then, you know, the search for a better world.
And also the civil rights movement, which Yip Harburg was passionately associated with. So yes, absolutely.
Another version that we're going to listen to is by the Hawaiian singer Israel Kamakawole.
Way up high, and the dreams that you dream of once in a lullaby.
So there we have a quite different version involving the ukulele.
Yes, from this lovely, light, fluttering sound coming from a morbidly obese man. It's just beautiful. That's slightly more escapist, I think, than maybe the Garland or the Ella Fitzgerald, who seem like they're trying to drive hope. That's a bit more wistful, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't know if you feel that. The Rainbow feels a little less reachable.
How close, David, do you think that song can become to Chintz?
The thing that brings it close to it is the strumming of the ukulele. I think the sort of slightly jaunty. I think the vocal delivery, the singing is beautiful, but it's the ukulele that sort of drags it sort of a little bit down.
Well, we'll move on to another song which is ingeniously linked to that one, which is one that I wrote about. Another song which is a tribute to American can-do optimism. It's A Hard Knock Life from the 1977 musical Annie. Well, if the previous song, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, had us looking dewy-eyed, this one had us jaunting about in syncopated moves.
Right, wow. So if Over the Rainbow is about the American quality of grit, digging deep and soaring high, then that song is all about the great American quality of pluck, isn't it? Pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
I think that's the perfect word there, Helen. And you can almost hear all of these plucked instruments, all of these pizzicato instruments being plucked away in a very merry fashion by the orchestra. It's a song which can't help but cheer you up, even though when you look at the lyrics, they they turn out to be absolutely dismal. To recap, in the film about the orphan Annie in her desolate New York orphanage, this song is sung by her fellow inmates in the orphanage, and they're bemoaning their full of sorrow life. Once a day, don't you want to throw the towel in? They chorus. I mean, this is all the sort of stuff of a Joy Division song, or maybe Leonard Cohen in one of his less happy moments. But nonetheless, the music is irresistibly propulsive and good-natured. Mm. And of course, this particular scene, which is accompanied by those wonderful sort of dance routines as the orphans spin around their washing equipment as they go through their drudgery and turn it into this wonderful choreography. It ends with Annie trying to escape in the laundry basket. There's no throwing the towel in from her. She is not a quitter.
Mm. And then the song gets smuggled into more recent popular culture by Jay-Z, who uses it for his Hard Knock Life ghetto
ghetto right.
experience. And I was thinking, how funny is that Annie is the girl who brings herself up out of poverty by her sheer pluck. And there's Jay-Z kind of taking himself mainstream for the first time with this song. It's also dealing with his life as a drug dealer. I mean, he's worked very hard to brand this. Although he was selling crack to make it on the way up, there he is, renowned by his clients of the time, as the drug dealer who would also be selling you crack but open the door for you at the bottom of the block of flats.
I don't know how to sleep, I gotta eat, stay on my toes. Got a lot of beef, so logically, I pray on my foes. Hustle's still inside of me, and as far as progress, you'd be hard-pressed. Find another rapper hot as me. I gave you prophecy on my first.
So yes, there is indeed a Hard Knock Life by an ex-drug dealer, as you put it, Helen, quite correctly.
Some amazing crate diving by him. But then, I mean,
he came across it. In fact, it turned out he came across this sample being played by a producer who created that sample, who created the beat. And he heard the beat and he really, really wanted it.
And reputedly,
he paid a sum of money in order to get hold of that beat, but he had to get permission to use it. So he wrote to the composer, Charles Strauss, and the lyricist, Martin Charnin, in order to ask permission from them to use it for the song. But in order to do so, he wrote basically this Annie-esque letter in which he said he loved the musical so much when he was growing up at his Hard Knock Bedford-Stuyvesant school, but he never got a chance to see it. But he absolutely loved it. He really wanted to use it. He really laid it on thick, and he sent it off to them, and they basically believed this.
I mean, he did see himself as a bit of an orphan Annie, though. I mean, his dad walked out when he was 9, and one of the things that I noticed from his book Decoded, he doesn't give away many details of his personal life, but the one thing he recalls in that is his parents fighting for custody of the vinyl collection.
And I may well be that the soundtrack to Annie may well have been on there, because he did end up producing the remake, which came out not so very long ago, which was a sort of hip-hop remake of the musical. So I think it has actually definitely gripped Jay-Z's imagination, the story of the plucky orphan girl.
And that film also features a little cameo from Katy Perry.
Yes, who then herself has gone and adopted It's a Hard Knock Life, which turns up, if you listen closely, which I think we can right now, to the beginning of her mega hit Roar, I think you could hear just a little echo of those orphans.
So Ludo, here we are again with American themes of empowerment and pluck with Katy Perry. As you say, you can hear the sort of the little echoes of It's the Hard Knock Life in there. I noticed when I was looking at this song up there, it has a credit of 5 songwriters, which is an astonishing number. Do they credit the song, or is there any sampling going on, or is it just like an unconscious echo?
She acknowledges it now by playing it. When she plays it live, it opens with It's a Hard Knock Life.
Okay.
Which then sort of dissolves into Roar. So it is acknowledged. There are other echoes in there, as well as the Helen Reddy song, I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar. Yeah.
Eye of the Tiger.
Eye of the Tiger as well, exactly. There's a whole load of empowerment anthems going on there. Mm. The thing about that is I sort of feel that there's something optimistic about songwriting itself. It seems to me that the way in which songwriters discuss songs, they talk about the tonic chord, they talk about resolving songs. There seems to be something sort of inherently optimistic, it seems to me, about the song itself, that in fact it's quite hard. I mean, obviously there's lots of gloomy songs, but actually songs themselves tend towards the positive.
that optimism. In fact, it's funny when you mentioned the Wichita Lineman earlier, that's one of the few songs that never resolved back to its tonic chord. It's like we leave him up there. But in this case, this is Katy Perry's getting up and getting out there. And you wouldn't write a song if you didn't want anyone to hear it, in a way. So there is some implied optimism in the act of creation, isn't there?
And there's often a juxtaposition, isn't there, between the downbeat lyrics but very upbeat music.
The majority of the songs in the book, of the 50 songs in the Life of a Song book, the majority are American, aren't they?
That's right.
And we're talking really about an art form which has achieved its highest level as an American popular culture.
Yeah.
So it seems that possibly the song and this optimistic spirit in the American temper possibly have met perfectly matched.
You know, it goes back to the days of, as Helen was saying, with sheet music, when, you know, that sort of democratized the song as well, when the songs were put back into the hands of ordinary people who could make their own interpretations on them.
For the people producing Over the Rainbow, how much you would make on the sheet music was a consideration, in a way that now even the number of downloads might not be a financial consideration. You're looking at monetizing it through your concert today.
It's a Hard Knot Life to me, but it raises questions about originality and copyism as well. And it seems to me that this particular song has been recycled very effectively, that those other versions are really good and the original is really good. Whereas it seems to me that the versions that we've heard of Starman and indeed of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, well, not so much Ella Fitzgerald, actually, that's true. But there's a sense in which the song is so powerful that it's very hard to do anything to it other than a sort of more minor key one like the Say Georges, for instance.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're right. I think some songs are not uncoverable, but they have their originality. His imprint so heavily on them that it's very hard for listeners to get that out of their head when they're listening to any other version.
That's different sort of when you've got sort of Tin Pan Alley writers. So, for example, you've got the Harburg and Arlem writing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. They wrote that for somebody else. They wrote that for other people to take on somewhere. Mm. Whereas when a song is more closely associated with the star persona, say in the David Bowie case, that was about him. That was about that particular moment in time. That was 1972 Top of the Pops. It's quite hard for anybody else to do that without making some very strong comment on him and their relationship with him in that moment.
Can I at this point just canvass opinions upon what makes a good cover? Helen, what do you think is a good cover version? What does a song need to bring to the original?
I quite like the ones that have a certain twist. So I quite like ones like the Say of Georges that do something different with the song, that take the song to a different place or a different meaning.
There's that dread word deconstructed, but when people sort of rethink a song or put a new twist on it or put a new angle on
like
it.
Like when Tori Amos covers Eminem, you know, and suddenly you're having that flip from that sort of male violence flipped into a feminist perspective. Yeah. I think that can be very interesting.
Yeah. And there are famous versions of songs. I mean, one of the ones covered in the book is Alleluia. And if you listen to Leonard Cohen's original, it's kind of clunky and very dated. And then you get Buckley coming along and totally transforming it into this exquisite sort of hymn. People now, apart from the Alexandra Bourke version, you know, it's Jeff Buckley's version that people remember.
And then, of course, there are songs which can be misunderstood or which can be sort of taken away from their original context, which applies to the last song that we shall be discussing, which also features in the book, which is Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. The column was written by FT music critic David Honigman. And David, you're going to tell us a bit about it.
Bruce Springsteen wrote it as a sort of it was basically a song about a petty criminal who goes to Vietnam and comes back with post-traumatic stress disorder. Lyrically, it's a pretty bleak song, but I think it falls victim to the fact that it's the tune. It's going back to the idea of juxtaposing things. It's a triumphalist song with a bright chords, an incredibly upbeat sort of rhythm, as a result of which it's been used, or rather abused, by politicians including Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump as a sort of a convention anthem. They're walking onto the stage and everybody does the fist pumping Born in the USA thing, and Springsteen hated that.
When Reagan used it during his re-election campaign in 1984, he gave a speech in New Jersey where he said, "America's future rests in 1,000 dreams inside your hearts. It rests in the message of hope in the songs of a man so many young Americans admire, New Jersey's own Bruce Springsteen," which evidently did horrify Springsteen himself, to hear himself being eulogised in that fashion. Helen, do you think the song deserves its fate? It is very pumped up.
Yeah, well, you know, I was 9 when this song came out, and I remember seeing the vinyl sleeves of it, the American flag, the blue jeans. I mean, it superficially, of course, it's playing against its own imagery, it's playing against its own sound. So I miss, you know, I don't think I listened to the lyrics when I was 9, and I wanted an aspiring indie kid with my henna hair and my Doc Martens. You know, this seemed to be a conservative anthem. I can see how it happens, and then you feel like a complete dolt when you realise you've missed the trick, you've missed the joke. I think it makes it cleverer, you know, I mean, because all that fist pumping is this guy's despair.
It does raise the question of, you know, how many people really listen to the lyrics of songs.
If we're talking about songs that change the world, that's got to be a problem.
Yes.
In this case, it seems to be that the chorus is the problem. I mean, it's so sort of blatant that it's very hard to move beyond it. And it seems that if this song is this song could change the world, it's not going to be in any way that the songwriter intends it to.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you should have followed it with some brackets, sort of, I'm born in the USA, don't I deserve better?
He did say, as his response to Reagan was, he said he was on tour at the time when Reagan used this, and he said, well, the president was mentioning my name in his speech the other day, and I kind of got to wondering what his favourite album of mine must have been, you know? I don't think it was the Nebraska album. I don't think he's been listening to this one. Nebraska being the much bleaker album that he produced with just himself and a guitar, and he then proceeded to play a song from Nebraska, very pointedly not the song which Reagan had appropriated.
I think too, Springsteen subsequently has played kind of a more stripped back arrangement of the song with just an acoustic guitar, and that sort of lays its bones a little bit more open.
I mean, there was a contradiction, I think, to some extent, in the way Springsteen was selling himself. I mean, his amazing new autobiography, I think, lays himself very bare. He talks about male vulnerability. But at that time in the 80s, he was buying into a certain macho imagery. I mean, he talks about, you know, working out obsessively, building up those muscles. He was playing into a certain image, which he's has gone on to deconstruct. Like David says, he's playing unplugged now. He's talking about depression and all the other lifelong struggles he's had in his book. But at that time, I think he was sending out a conflicted message.
There is an expectation that pop and rock stars are kind of liberal, left-leaning. And yet, as David Honigman points out in his piece on the song, rock and roll is essentially a libertarian activity. It's about sticking it to the man. It's about the rugged individual. In a way, they're quite right-wing values. So there is a contradiction there, I think.
Do you find your own opinion towards the song can change as well? I mean, I remember with Born in the USA, I detested that song
when
it came out. It's like the absolute example of stadium rock at its worst.
Awful.
Those big drums whacking around the heads, and then Springsteen bellowing like a sort of vast wounded bull. I mean, no, it was awful. But now I love it.
Yeah, exactly.
I love the song now.
We've been on the same journey, yeah.
So Born in the USA, as well as having been appropriated by Reagan, then turned up in a rather unusual setting 6 years later when it was used by the rap group 2 Live Crew in a very pointed fashion.
Speech will never die for us to have our ancestors die. Don't keep thinking that we were quick. We'll always stand and never sit. We're too loud, too black, too strong. Doing the right thing and not the wrong. So listen up, y'all, do what we say. We won't be banned in the USA.
Say banned in the USA. Y'all say this.
This song, which was released in 1990, followed the banning of their album, As Nasty As They Wanna Be, in the state of Florida, and it was banned for purportedly being obscene. And their response was this song, banned in the USA. They got permission from Springsteen to use the sample of the song. And this was a freedom of speech defense, First Amendment, in which they assert their right to be able to say what they want. And it was, interestingly, this song was the first to carry the parental advisory sticker, which has now spread like a rash over songs.
Did it merit a parental advisory sticker? Do we know?
Well, in one sense, I suppose it did merit it in so much as it was taking on that rock and roll tradition you just mentioned, David, of sticking it to the man. Rap music in many ways took over that in the 90s and became something which was looked upon as dangerous. I mean, it carried with it lots of racially freighted anxieties. But basically, the idea of music existing to shock your parents was taken on board by rap music.
Yeah.
But so, Helen, you didn't like Born in the USA when it first came out, and like me, have come around to it. What do you think of it turning up here?
I quite like that. I like people taking a tune and running with it, and confronting the idea of, I mean, the song is about what it means to be American. So this is then picking that up and running with it. It's like, you know, freedom of speech, First Amendment. You know, it's the right we should have. And I like the way they've claimed it and taken it further.
I think too, maybe there's something to be said here about the way the art of songwriting has changed, in the sense that sampling has introduced a new element. And old school traditionalists kind of look at this and say, well, it's not sort of proper songwriting, going back to the sort of classic era of the singer, the lonely, tortured singer-songwriter. But these days, as we mentioned about the Katy Perry song, there are sometimes four, five or six people credited with writing these songs. So it's a different process these days, isn't it?
And I don't think it was ever pure, was it? I mean, there's quite a lot of Over the Rainbow in Dvorak's Ode to the Moon. So pop music was always borrowed from classical music and jazz. And that's probably goes back deeper into traditions and oral songs. We've always done it.
I feel very impatient with complaints that samples are just a sort of lazy form of recycling or theft, which does, I mean, obviously they can be used lazily, but it seems to me that, we can sometimes forget that pop music is meant for young people, and that it constantly, its audience is constantly being replenished by new recruits of said youngsters. And for them, what are they going to care about the original version of Starman, or the fact that, you know, It's a Hard Knock Life turns out to have been done long before Katy Perry ever did Raw.
And it's exciting as well, I think, you know, and I certainly think with the invention of the internet, you know, there's a certain kind of young geek who can really enjoy tracing the trail back, you know, discovering that Eminem sampling Labrie Siffre, go back and discover Labrie Siffre, you've got a bit of cool there. You might, you know, then you can rework that yourself. I think it's part of the excitement. It's all available online now.
It seems to me that there are far too many songs as well. I mean, I don't know. of the 50 songs that we have in the Life of a Song book, we have 50, you know, classics, basically.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you're a songwriter, what are you adding to that? I mean, pinch something from them. Turn them into new things. Don't bother trying to write something new. It's not going to work.
I mean, every song that I've written about in this column, I've gone back and found something older than I expected to find.
Although, of course, it's all original journalism.
Of course, yes.
And on that note, it remains for me to thank my guests today, Helen and David. Thank you very much for your contributions.
It's been an adventure.
And I hope that you've enjoyed the podcast, and I heartily recommend to you The Life of a Song in its book form, which will be available in all good bookshops and indeed online stores.
And it's available in the UK on September the 21st and in the US on October the 31st.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This podcast was produced by Griselda Murray Brown.